What does a professional chef want us home cooks to know about cooking food at home? Today's guest is Sandy Leibowitz. She's a trained chef with experience in restaurants as a personal chef, and now as an educator teaching people like me how to be more efficient and effective in their kitchens. As a note, we had a few technical issues with audio during this episode, so you'll notice the sound quality is a bit different than our episodes normally are. Sandy's advice is so good that I did not want to skip this episode just for the sake of the audio, so I hope you enjoy. Sandy, thank you for being here and being willing to take some time to share with our audience the insights you have as a professional chef. Could you share with us, before we dive into all the questions I have for you, what is your background, your training? Like, where did you kind of come through in the professional chef world?
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I started at Culinary School at the Culinary Institute of America, and I did that for 2 years, and then I went into the restaurant world in New York City, worked with a bunch of chefs for many years, and that kind of turned into me working on my personal chef's company, and then blogging, and then that kind of led me to the online space in a nutshell, but that's kind of like the trajectory that it took. And I really just, through all that, I found that I've always been leaning toward the teaching aspect of the cooking. So like, instead of just giving recipes or even cooking for people, I love that, but I really, really loved the part where people were like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. Or, you know, the teaching part where they would get those aha moments, I think that's kind of where I gravitated and where I really focus now.
So what are some of the really important things that you try to teach people who are like, okay, I don't want to work in a restaurant. I just want to be able to like consistently feed my family well at home. What are some of the things that you really think are some of the most important skills or tasks that they could learn to do in the home?
I would say, number one, you have to be open to really experimenting and not being afraid to fail, because a lot of times I think people get so stuck on the recipe that, you say this all the time, you know, that if you don't have the ingredient, or if you don't really, I don't know, understand like the process, like you feel kind of locked into it. And cooking doesn't have to be that way. It really is about just experimenting, having fun. And it really doesn't have to be complicated. I love your approach of eating at home doesn't have to be cooking at home. Focus on the techniques that you're doing. Read the recipe through and really try to understand what's the concept that's going on. What is it asking of you? Okay, so I'm sauteing some aromatics, and then I'm browning some meat, and then I'm adding sauce. So it's like three components that come together. So when you think about it like that, and most importantly, think of it ahead of time. Take that moment, kind of front load and think, you know, what is it asking of me? Then the more that you do that, the more you understand, this is really not that hard and I can do that. And someday, like you said recently, it could be, I'm going to try this new recipe because I have time and I don't have to drive my kids somewhere. Or no, tonight is like eggs, potatoes, and onions, you know, and that's okay. That happens too. So I think just overall that willingness to, you know, just be open to trying new things, taking mental notes and preparing ahead of time.
Yeah. And really, like, the more you do it, the better you get at it, I think, too, right? Like, I've had people say to me before, like, well, you like cooking or you enjoy cooking or whatever. And I'm like, I do now, but I started out not liking it and very much felt like it was a chore, very much felt like it was something that was overwhelming. But what I like to say is like, well, if I cook dinner like over half of the nights per year, that means that I'm cooking dinner like 200 times a year, and I've done that for 10 years. Like, at that point, you kind of just get good at it if you've done it that many times. And so I like that you're telling people it's okay to fail, or it's okay to like cook something and be like, oh, this could have been better. And instead of just being like, well, that recipe fell flat and so I should never make it again, instead taking a learner mindset of like, oh, what could I have tweaked about that that would have made it better? Because that'll just improve us. Even if we decide that recipe itself was not a winner, it's still going to improve how we approach it the next time we try to go about it. And I think just getting our reps in, right? Like, just the repetition of doing it over and over is going to eventually improve our skills. We don't have to be good at it. And in fact, we shouldn't be good at it right away.
Absolutely. And to the point also of what you said, I also want to preface this by saying there's really no mistake per se in cooking. And again, I really align with what you say, how you talk about this on your stories a lot, that, you know, it's it can be fixed. It's not like baking, you know, where it has to be precise. It's going to maybe take a different turn than maybe you originally thought. And maybe you like it more. And maybe you like it less. But taking those mental notes of your own thought, but also kind of checking, you know, what is the family saying? Like, my husband will eat anything, you know? He's like my guinea pig for the most part. But the kid, as you know, will definitely let you know. And sometimes I'll say, like, is it the chicken you don't like? Or is it, like, because it's too crispy? Or is it because it's too saucy? Like, I know from experience, my kids do not like the saucy type of chicken unless it's in chicken soup. So you may, you know, think, you may know this about your kids, that they have this particular like or dislike. So just, you know, tweak that. But you don't have to, like, forego the whole dish that you made, because it might have parts that are good. And maybe, I don't think it, but a lot of times it's just the salt. Sometimes it's just the salt. You know what I mean?
Yes. I think it's so true, especially, like, now that I've spent more time cooking not following a recipe than I have trying to precisely follow a recipe. A lot of times when I do follow a recipe and they say, like, small dash of salt or something, and so you try to do that and then you taste it and it's like, I don't taste any salt at all in this. I think that salt and seasonings are a big one, that it's like, I feel like if people could understand how much it takes of those different things and how they work together, then it really changes your confidence in the kitchen. Because I know a lot of times with home cooked meals, the perception is like, oh, home cooking is so bland and that's why I prefer to eat out. And like you said, it's like, that's a very solvable problem. That's a very fixable thing if we learn how to salt and season things in a way that would make it something that we actually enjoy eating and enjoy tasting. So for people who don't currently cook this way at all, where they're listening to this and they're like, if I had to cook something without following a recipe, it would just not work out. Is there any meal, one or two meals where you're like, okay, this would be a good starting place to try this without a recipe?
It's hard to come up with something offhand, because I like, though, a lot of people will ask, like, oh, you know, your background, your kids must eat so wonderfully and this and that, and I really am not like that. Like, I make very specific things that they like, and I myself just try to focus on the technique. So it's hard to kind of pinpoint a particular meal, but I would say, more than anything, look at any meal you want to do, and kind of like what you said, you know, the amount of instruction and the amount of ingredients. Read it through and say, okay, this is really just browning the meat and adding the sauce. Like, at the end of the day, that's what I'm doing. So focus on the techniques that are specific to that. Like, I don't know, I make ground meat, or, you know, tacos a lot. I'm sure a lot of people do. That actually is a good example of something you don't really need to measure anything. But I always talk about this on my stories and stuff, that my reaction is the technical term for the browning of the meat, right? And a lot of people miss this step, where they'll just kind of make the meat not pink anymore. Like, it'll be gray. I call it gray, boring meat. And people at the beginning, when they hear that, they hate hearing it, because they're like, what do you mean? What's wrong with my meat?
Yeah.
But when they try to take that little extra time, a little higher heat, maybe a little more fat, depending what you're using, so like it's leaner, adding a little more cooking fat, and, you know, really getting a crust on there and developing that flavor, it is such a difference that it can change completely, and you don't need to add more than, like, salt, garlic, and onion, you know? And if you wanted to add the extra, like, the cumin and the coriander or something, you can. But literally, eyeballing it, it's not going to make or break the dish. Okay. You know, some spices, like cumin, that's a little bit more potent. You know, you might want to go easy if you're, like, sensitive to that. But for the most part, we're, like, by, you know, chili flakes or something like that. But for the most part, you know, a little more granulated garlic. I mean, a lot of people like garlic. But, you know, another example, even coriander. Like, it's not going to make or break the dish. But focusing on the browning, that technique, and then it's just the spices and the seasoning.
I was going to say that I was thinking of taco night in my head when I asked that question. So I'm glad that you brought that up, because I do think that, in addition to maybe like a grill night, like grilling burgers or something, I think a taco meat is the perfect thing to just decide, okay, I'm going to master this without needing to follow that I'm doing like one tablespoon of chili powder and one tablespoon of garlic. You know, like there's not a reason that you need to like measure it in those precise terms. And I think just eyeballing it and being willing to then try it and be like, what does this need more of, is going to make you more in tune with how those different spices are making the flavors change, as opposed to just following someone's recipe exactly. Because I think tacos is another reason that's a great thing to try for, is that it's so picky eater friendly, because you can make the meat and then everybody can doctor it up as much or as little as they want. And, you know, the kid that doesn't like tortillas can just eat the meat. And the one who wants to put all the toppings on it can put all the toppings. So I think that really plays into what you're saying of like mastering the technique as opposed to mastering a recipe, an individual recipe. Because then when you master that, then you can play around with using it in different forms. Or I didn't have ground beef, even though the recipe called for that, but I now understand that I could use ground turkey and it's going to be the same, or, you know, whatever that is, that you can then adapt it to maybe what's on sale or what you just already have on hand, as opposed to feeling tied to that individual recipe. So yeah, one of my questions was, what do you think people can learn to do without a recipe? And I think that's a really great starting point, is being able to properly cook a protein up without needing to have someone say like exactly what the spices and seasonings and cook times are. Learning to be in tune with your senses, I think, is something that chefs are really good at, is that they know the sight of something, they know the sound of something, they know the smell of something. I know it really annoys people when I bake things and I have no idea what, they're like, oh, how long did you bake it? And I say, until I smelled it.
Right, I'm the same way. I mean, never mind baking, because I'll let this like a one bowl, I don't even bother, but baking is not my forte because of that. That you're good at that. But yes, actually, as you were talking, I was thinking about how it's more than just taco meat or something. I think I'm going to go on out on a limb here and say that most things that we do at home, again, kind of a blanket statement, but I think most things you could feel comfortable to experiment without the recipe if you first follow what I said before, which is, if you want to follow the recipe, look at it first, read it in its entirety, and see what is the concept. Once you understand the concept, then you can break down, okay, you know, maybe it's not browning, maybe it's cooking it completely in liquid. But mastering that, like, for example, another small detail that people miss is if they're cooking chicken breast in particular, that tends to be on the drier side. If they're cooking it in liquid, if they let it get to that point of boiling, it's now going to be tough and chewy and not as pleasant if you just let it simmer slowly. And maybe, you know, maybe it takes a little longer. I mean, chicken breast long, but you know what I'm saying? Like, in comparison to letting it just on this rolling boil, and then now you've got this, like, rubbery chicken, you know? So looking at it that way, too, it's like, what is that technique or that skill? So most things, I mean, I know it's a blanket statement, but I do think that most things, unless it's a very complicated recipe, like you said, lots of steps or ingredients, you could probably, if you're willing to experiment and to see what happens and take notes, nothing bad will happen. I mean, honestly, I've heard so many things and, you know, yeah, it stinks and you might waste the money or the time, but like, then you learn and you move on.
And I think another thing that happened for me when I first started trying to cook a lot at home, I was always doing recipes. So I was like trying to follow specific recipes every time I cooked. But over time, I started to realize that at their core, they're all almost the same. You know, like I'm like doing very similar things, that you're cooking up some sort of starch or carb that goes with it, so whether that's potatoes or pasta or bread or whatever, and then there's a protein that you're seasoning in different ways, but you're either like roasting it or cooking it, and then there's usually some sort of sauce or seasoning or, you know, thing that binds it together. But I was finding through that repetition that I could benefit so much more by just learning what those general methods were than I could by trying to say, oh, I really like this specific recipe. So like, I think roasting vegetables is a perfect example of that, of like, once you understand the method, it doesn't really matter what the which vegetable you happen to have. You can learn, like, okay, as long as they're like uniformly sliced, and I need to have a certain amount of fat, and I need to have some salt. And then if they're, you know, thinner, then it's going to be a lower heat for less time. If it's something like a potato, a sweet potato, it's going to take a little bit longer. But once you understand like the basic method, then you can just adjust it to the food you have, as opposed to like Googling how to roast broccoli, how to roast sweet potatoes. Like, once you understand roasting, then you can adapt it for the food that you happen to have.
I love that you said that, because that is my whole vibe. Like, that is exactly why my business exists. I mean, if you think about, I mean, I'm sure you know the quote, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. If you teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. And I know it's really corny, but that is really what I'm all about, because that's exactly right. In the simplest of terms, when it comes to roasting, you know, it is just a formula that you are following, a certain amount of fat, even a range of heat. I'm sure you've noticed it doesn't really matter if you're at like, you know, 375 or even 450, you know, like it's a range. I mean, every oven is going to be different, and every, you know, pan and all that. But the basic idea, I'm kind of like impressed that you are so intuitive to figure that out, because a lot of people don't. And I think I just want to get that out there, like more where it's like, that's what I mean by the concept, the form, though, the overall framework. I mean, that's what I teach. And so you plug in what you want. The recipe doesn't have to tell you. You don't need the recipe to, like, back in the taco example. Oh, you have turkey, you know, it's more lean. So you might need to add a little more protein fat, because you know that in that cooking method, it's a dry cooking method, which is confusing because oil seems like it's wet, but it's not. It's oil and water don't mix. But yeah, it basically, like, you're following these steps. And tonight I'm using turkey, or tonight, like you said, the denture of the vegetable might need to be cooked longer, or perhaps part cooked before or something like that. But overall, you know, some cooking methods are a little bit more tricky in terms of, you know, they're not as straightforward as just like putting it in the oven. But that's like the general idea. Get familiar with that. Get to know what are those steps. And then you can just say, oh, I don't have to run to the store because I have whatever vegetable.
I think one of the reasons I clued into it finally after a while was that sometimes I would make a recipe and it would say, you know, roast the potatoes at 400. And then I would make another recipe and it says roast the potatoes at 425. And you start over time, you start to clue into like, they didn't turn out any differently, you know? And so then I think that helps you to kind of see like, oh, there isn't a one magic formula, and it has to be, like you said, I think we get confused with baking and cooking a lot, right? Like if a cake recipe says bake at 325 and you bake it at 375, you've ruined the cake. But if you take, you know, if you're roasting broccoli and it says roast it at 375 and you roast it at 400, it's not going to be any different. But it is hard to kind of separate those two and get used to being more flexible with the way that you cook. You know, I like to say that like baking is a science and cooking is more of an art. Like if we had, there's science behind cooking for sure, but the approach that we can take can be more one of what do I feel like eating? Like what flavors do I like to have? More of that individualistic, as opposed to the baking has to be like, if they say a teaspoon of baking powder, I can't just skip that and expect it to still work.
Exactly. And I love that word, flexible. You know, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. So you said earlier that salting is really important, and sometimes that is just all it takes, is that something was undersalted or improperly salted. Can you give a very brief overview of what does it mean to properly salt something, and how can someone learn to do that?
So first you have to separate, I think people have salt and spice kind of combined in their mind, and very different. Just remember that salt is a mineral. It treats the food, or it behaves differently with the food. So it's going to bring out moisture. It's going to bring out the flavor that is in the food. Spices, on the other hand, add flavor, right? Different notes. It's almost like the salt is raising the volume on the flavor. So if you have something that is I don't know. For some reason, I just have the taco seasoning in my head, but like chili powder, you know, if you're adding the salt, I mean, chili powder, depending what you buy, it could be a little on the sweeter side. It could be a little on the spicier side, right? That salt is going to bring out those notes of that spice. So if you eyeballed it and you put it on your taco meat and you add a little too much salt, it may go over the top, but you can fix it. You can add an acid and kind of, you know, like a seesaw, you know, you can kind of balance mm-hmm. that out that way. So the first is to recognize that they're different. And more often than not, the salt is where you want to go, because it's just like the thing that moves the needle, you know? Mm-hmm. So I always recommend kind of ditching the salt shaker or like the, you know, even the grinder, mm-hmm. you know, they're fine. But like you said before, it's not just chefs, home cooks too. You want to get into the feel of it. And actually touching the salt and feeling the salt is going to get you more in tune with, like, oh, that was a little bit bigger of a pinch, or, you know, it's hard to describe until you actually implement it, but it's really important that you grab the salt. I like kosher salt because it's coarser. The type you use makes a huge difference. I mean, I prefer Diamond Crystal, but there are ones that, like, people are diehards, you know, they either love Morton, you know, and it's way saltier by volume. So if you like it, great, but stick to it, learn it, see what it does, you know, because it's going to make a difference. Like, I know when I go to other people's houses or, you know, and I try something different, it makes a huge difference. So again, I think it's just being more mindful, you know, of what you're doing, how you're doing it, using your senses. So yeah, start with the cellar, the salt cellar, using mm-hmm. salt with your hand, and maybe salting a little bit as you go. So if you're sauteing onions and garlic, you add a little bit there. I mean, you might have heard the term season as you go. I agree to a certain degree. I think there's room for error there. You don't want to overdo it. So more importantly is taste as you go. So, you know, you really want to think about that. Like, you add a little bit, you can always add a little bit more. I mean, nothing wrong is going to happen if you add a little bit at the end. Yes, it's not as, like, you know, throughout, but mm-hmm. I mean, while you're learning, it's okay to do that. And then I would just say just continue to just be mindful of, like, what it tastes like. Taste as you go and just see how you like it.
I think that's something that a lot of home cooks don't do, is taste testing. Like, as you cook, being able to take, obviously don't take a bite of raw meat, but, like, as you go, like, once the meat is browned, season it, eyeball it, and then take a bite and actually think about what does it need more of, or what did I do too much of, or whatever it is, in order to keep going. Because I think that does get you more in tune with, like, okay, how does this little pinch of salt change the flavor? Okay, how does another little pinch? Okay, now I can see how that affected it. So I like that. I don't have a salt cellar, but I should get one and do it by hand.
Listen, you got everything else kind of, you know.
I do. Natural. I'm almost there. I'm almost a pro. No, not at all.
But I do. I mean, with your grinder, if you are comfortable with it, it's just, you know, the taste, you know, because some people just kind of keep going with the grinder and then they don't pay attention for what that actually is doing to the food, you know.
Yeah, I think by now with the grinder, I use Morton kosher salt in the grinder. And so I think by now I know, I don't even know if I could give a number, but I think just like muscle memory, I almost have like a, this is how many turns I do kind of thing. Like, I know I can salt a bowl of popcorn perfectly with my grinder, just like knowing how much it takes. But that is practice. I've definitely oversalted before. So let's talk about that. You've taught, like, obviously if something is undersalted, we just add more salt. What do we do if we feel like something is oversalted? If we messed up and this is, and you know, you take that taste test bite and something is like way more salty than what you wanted it to be.
So there's a couple things you could do. You could, depending what it is, it's funny, I had a post about this. I mentioned that all the other things except a potato or like a starch, and like all the comments were like, potato. It's like,
potato.
I know, it's just that not every, you know, like if you're cooking a soup or a stew where a potato would work, then sure, add a potato, you know.
Right.
But sometimes you can't just add a potato to something, and so there's other options. So the first comes to mind is like an acid. So an acid, work to kind of balance it out. And that could be anything from, you know, lemon, vinegar, wine, depending. Again, it's really hard to kind of give an exact example because it depends what you're cooking. But again, there's no mistake. So, you know, while I may like apple cider vinegar with my roast, you know, other people may like lemon, and it could still work, you know. Mm-hmm. Or you may think, well, I want to make this more Mexican themed, so I'm going to do lime instead, you know, or something like that. But it's still an acid and it's still a liquid. So I don't want to get sidetracked, but to answer your question, you can go like the opposite. So you could do an acid, you could do a starch to absorb. You could also add more volume so that it can
dilute it.
Yeah, right. Diluted. I was confused though. Right. So you're going to add more so that it kind of disperses throughout more volume. And clearly you could see why I'm better at cooking and not baking, because when it comes to math, this is interesting. People that love numbers and math and science, they tend to gravitate towards the baking or the science part of the cooking.
Right.
But then the people like me, where they are not good at that at all, but they focus on more of the senses. And I think that's what's so cool about it, that you can kind of do either one, and you're still going to be okay, you know? You're still going to have a delicious meal if you focus on the right thing.
When it seems like there should be more left in your bank account and your money seems too complicated to keep track of, the Debt-Free Mom Custom Budget Service takes the guesswork out of your next budget. Send us your real numbers and you'll receive two versions of your pay period budget. The original, so you can see how your money is currently flowing, and a suggested budget with changes we recommend to prioritize your money goals. Sign up for your custom budget today at debtfreemom.co/custom.
Yeah. What about sugar? Does sugar offset salt or no?
Oh, yeah. You could definitely do like a sweet and salty kind of thing where you're balancing it that way. But again, go easy, pay it, and it does. You know, don't just like throw it in and be like, okay, we're good. You know, it's all about the taste, because that's how you're going to train your palate.
I remember cooking, like, if you look up, you know, homemade spaghetti sauce recipes, I always remember being confused about why there was sugar and salt, because they felt like opposites. But now understanding like the acid of the tomato, I now understand why both are serving two different purposes, with like the sugar kind of softening the acid flavor, but then the salt bringing out the flavors of all of them. So it's just interesting how those all work together. Like you said, it's like there is a whole sciencey side of the cooking and why all of those things are working.
I love that you actually like to learn about that. You know, there's a certain type of person that will like that, and others that are like, I want to just kind of validate that for a second. It's okay also if you're not like, oh, I want to know all the things. You can kind of narrow it down to the most important things and not really get into the nitty gritty, and that's okay. You just get food on the table too. Like there's nothing wrong with that.
Right. And I think that's a helpful point that you bring up, because the intention is not that everybody dives into the world of cooking and invests all of their time in figuring out how to be a perfect cook. It's actually that these things can alleviate the task of cooking for people who don't enjoy it, right? Like if we don't want to spend all of our time laboring over choosing recipes and following them exactly, the methods and the advice that you're sharing can actually reduce how much time someone spends mentally mulling it over and physically being in the kitchen, so that the meal comes together quicker. And so if you are someone who enjoys it, then yes, dive into the world of all of the things that you can learn. And there's, you know, an infinite depth of knowledge that you could figure out. But if you are someone who doesn't enjoy it, but finds the value in having the skill, right? It's like learning how to like change a tire. Like I'm never going to enjoy it, but I want to know how, just for the functionality, right? And we can take a totally functional approach to cooking too, of like, I just want to be able to get meals on the table without feeling stressed about it. And so I'm going to take just a little bit of time to learn the basics so that it's something that I can do. If my goal is not to enjoy it, at least it can become a little more automatic.
Exactly. If I can share a small tidbit about that, even for me, there are times where, you know, I'll look at my meal planning for the week. And sometimes, like you always say, you know, there's time for a little more experimentation. And maybe there's weeks where there really just is not time. But because of my knowledge and because of what I can kind of conjure up in a moment, I know that if I stick to those basics, I'm still going to have a really good meal that doesn't have to be fancy, for lack of a better word. But I know, you know, that I want to switch it up throughout the week. So I'll have maybe, I don't know, just a seared chicken breast. But I know that that seared chicken breast is going to come out juicy and, you know, golden brown and delicious. And it could just be garlic and lemon and some rice and broccoli, but it's going to be done well. That is going to be infinitely more delicious than if you're like trying to follow this recipe and there's somebody that's getting frustrated along the way. You know, it's just, it's a lot of steps if you're like, you look at it like it's a rule book, you know, it's just a guide. And, you know, I know that some people may think that, but then they still get caught up in it. And you don't have to. You can rely on those basic things. And then maybe the next day is something a little bit more saucier, like a stew. But again, I know that I'm taking the time to brown because that's going to make the difference ultimately in the dish versus if I just cooked my brown meat and it's just gray. And I mean, I've done it recently. I remember I did it by accident because I was kind of like rushing. And I didn't take the time, or I put too much in the pan or something. And I remember thinking, wow, now I know what a difference this is because it even changes the texture. Like, it's not as pleasant because it doesn't have that, like, you know, that enjoyable chew or that depth of flavor that comes from browning. You know, it's little things like that that you can have those meats, make it simple, you know, and maybe it's not all the protein and the starch. I know you have your little setup too, which I like. I just stick to protein, veggie, and a starch. But there could be times where maybe it's just the protein and a veggie, you know, or egg, you know, and something like that. Really simple. So, you know, as long as you know what to focus on, I think that can narrow down and reduce that mental load a little bit.
It's like if instead of viewing it as the more complicated the recipe, the better it's going to taste. Like when you nail the basics, you don't actually feel the need to find out what the ultra complicated versions are. I know when Kyle first started, he got interested in the salt, fat, acid, heat, the documentary, and then he got the book and was reading that. Instead of, you know, when you would maybe think that what would come out of that would be complicated things, you know, things that are really unusual for like just a regular home cooked meal on a Tuesday. But the first two things that he wanted to master after he read that and watched that were an omelet and a home roasted chicken. And it was like just those basics, right? Of just like, okay, I've eaten scrambled eggs my whole life. If I actually learn how to do it properly, it actually tastes nothing like the scrambled eggs that I've been eating for decades.
Oh my God. Oh, the first thing. Yeah. It's this huge pyramid.
We don't have to change the foods that we eat. We can just change the methods that we're using to cook them, and it will taste like a completely different meal. We did Samin's roasted chicken. It was a buttermilk chicken. That's what it was. And so you like let it soak in buttermilk for like 24 hours. But it was nothing that you couldn't find in like your basic grocery store, right? Like, so what we started to learn was that these people that we really admired about the way they cooked, they weren't going out and finding the most like unusual, hard to find ingredients. They were just making the basics and doing it well. And so I think a good, really good example of it is like going out for a steak dinner. Like, you can absolutely learn how to cook a phenomenal steak on a cast iron at home. Like, you don't have to go to the fancy steakhouse in order to experience that. And if you think about the plate that they end up serving you, it's like three whole ingredients, right? You get a steak and broccoli and a baked potato. And so once you start thinking, all three of these things are at my grocery store and I could learn how to cook these well, you really start to change your approach.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to that point too, about the chickens. So for example, I don't mix meat and dairy together. And that's a perfect example where like I would want to make something like that, but I would instead use like coconut milk instead of buttermilk because I still mix the two together. And for people that are maybe dairy free, you know, they can do something like that as an example where they can think like, okay, what is also creamy and, you know, how, or maybe I need to add a little more acid because buttermilk you know, doesn't have, or buttermilk has the acid. And so think about what is it doing to the dish? You know, it's helping to kind of break it down a little bit and tenderize it. So when you understand those things, again, you know, I think all that we're talking about could be summed up into the same thing. It's just like thinking about the things that matter. So it's the technique, it's how you're seasoning, when you're seasoning. Obviously, the better, fresher ingredients are going to be better. But listen, I know things are too, in the past, I've always used jars of garlic myself also. But does the food come out better when I chop it myself? Of course, you know. But again, determining what day of the week is it, you know, if I've got to take my kid to piano, I don't have time for that. Or if I didn't have the kinds of plan, then the jar it is, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that either. But knowing that when I do have the time, it's going to make a difference, knowing how to, you know, chop that properly so it can give you the right amount of flavor or whatever. So whatever you're doing, you know, maybe you want to taste for a salsa versus a mint for something else, you know. So yeah, it all kind of boils down to those things. And that's really where I like to focus, because that's going to give home cooks more of that skill, that lifelong skill, like you said, where you can quickly Google something and just be like, okay, these things look the same about the recipe, you know, what else can I do to make it my own or something like that? And how cool is it, you know, when you can, when you have time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just cool that the same thing works both ways, that it can allow you to really invest a lot of time and energy into it if it's something you enjoy. But at the same time, learning it can also make it easier. And if you want to spend more time cooking, or if you want to spend less time cooking, the answer to both of those is to learn the basics well, right? Like if you want to really get into it and do it well, you can dive into all of that and figure it out because it's fun for you and enjoyable. But also, if you want to spend less time and less energy on cooking while still eating at home, the answer is the same. Figure out the basics, know how to season something, know how to be flexible with the ingredients, and it'll make it quicker instead of, you know, making a recipe, being 10% of the way through it and realizing you don't have soy sauce and feeling like you have to go to the store and get soy sauce instead of just saying what would be an easy swap and making that swap on the spot in your own kitchen can really cut down on how much time that takes you. Okay, well, I could just keep talking and talking because I really enjoy talking about this cookie. If people are listening and they're like, yes, I need more of what Sandy is teaching because I want to be a home cook, but I'm not one right now, what kind of services and products do you offer and where can people find you?
Thank you. So they can find me on Instagram. I'm most active there. I'm at Plantains and Chala, but it's spelled like Chala. It's just pronounced Chala, which is a little throaty sound. And I have two services at the moment. So I have a cooking skill course, which focuses exactly on these things that we talked about. You know, I dive into like really what matters. So everything that I went to school for, cooked in the industry for years, what fluff and what matters and what can get you good home cooking. So that's called Cook Without Recipes. and so that's my cooking skill course. And then I also offer a nice skill course called Chop It Like It's Hot. And that is I have cohort extra time, and this is like my baby because, you know, this is a big part of cooking is to make sure that, like you said, efficiency number one starts with your prep. So you have to make sure that you're cutting things not only uniformly so they cook evenly, but also, you know, so that you're efficient in the kitchen and you're not spending the whole time chopping instead of cooking, right? So I offer that as well. And I would love to offer a little discount for your listeners, and you can put that in the show notes. But also, I'm always available for questions. I love talking about this stuff, too. And I just, you know, I love to give people these skills and have them feel more confident in the kitchen.
Amazing. Awesome. Well, yes, we will link your Instagram and we will link your website in the show notes with a little discount, so that people who want to do exactly what the title is and learn to cook without a recipe can learn from you. Thank you for taking time to be able to share all of this and get that, because I know that, you know, you are the professional. I'm the one that has like the amateur home experience, but I think hearing it from a professional that these are very doable things in the home is a real confidence booster for those listening. So thanks.
Welcome to another segment of Not Worth Your Money. I'm Kyle and I'm here with Carly, and we're going to talk about something that may or may not be worth it to spend your money on. And as our last segment of our Feed the Family month focused on food spending, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Is a chest freezer worth it?
So we just got one for the first time 6 months ago, right after we moved into this house.
We were given one.
I know, that's what I was going to say.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so we got one last September, I think. And I don't think I would have purchased one. I don't think I would have gone out and purchased one, but we were given one by Kyle's parents who had one in their garage from someone else, and they no longer wanted it.
So we're off to a great start.
We're 3 degrees removed from the original.
Fruit people did not want
the original purchaser. So the reason that one of the main reasons we got it is that when we moved to this house, the fridge and freezer that comes with this rental is substantially smaller than the fridge and freezer that we had at our previous home. I loved the fridge that we had at our old house. We actually tried to bring it with us and it physically wouldn't go through the doors. I don't know what kind of voodoo magic they did to get it into the house. It had to have been in like 10 different pieces when it arrived at that house and then assembled in the kitchen, because even like you guys measured, I think, like even if the doors had come off, it would have been.
We would have had to take the molding off of the door frames in order to get.
And take the doors off of the fridge.
And the doors off the fridge. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Anyways, I wanted that fridge to come with us and it didn't. So now I have a pretty small fridge for feeding 6 people. And we also eat the vast majority of our meals at home. So I have a lot of food on hand. So we now have for those watching on video, we have a mini fridge in the office that holds all of our beverages. And then we have a chest freezer in the basement for supplementing the freezer here. So I now am very grateful that we have a chest freezer and am able to keep more things on hand than I would be if we just had the fridge that's here. I went, 11 years of our married life without having a chest freezer. I could continue to do that if I needed to. It's not a make or break. Now that we have one, I'm not like, I'm never going back and I'm always going to own one. It's a great option. And I will say I have slightly changed the way that I approach groceries because I know that I have the additional space. So for example, we like the meat from Costco, the chicken in particular. There's a taste difference in between Aldi and Costco chicken. But the only option you have is this enormous pack that is about 9 pounds. Like I looked at the most recent one I bought was 9.5 pounds. I could not fit all of that into the little freezer in our regular fridge, plus all of the other stuff. But because we now have the larger freezer, I'm able to grab that. I also, a couple weeks ago, Walmart had loaves of Italian bread on clearance because they were about to expire and they were 54 cents a loaf. And so I grabbed 2 of them and put them in the freezer. And we used one of them a couple nights ago for garlic bread. So it was a 50 cent loaf of garlic bread.
Yeah. We also stocked up on butter because
it was on sale.
It was on sale for $1 off. So we got like 6 pounds of butter and just threw it in the freezer.
Yeah. So I'm grateful for having it. And I think it does help with some of those things. My big caveat on that is it helps if you can be disciplined about buying things that are on sale when you have the budget for it. I know I've talked many, many times with people as I'm building their budget or on Instagram who are caught in the cycle of being almost unable to pass up a deal. So if they see something that's on sale, they will buy it regardless of if they have a plan for using it, if they have physical space to store it, and if they have room in their budget. And so then they end up going over because something is always going to be on sale. So like you're never going to walk into a grocery store and see absolutely nothing on clearance. So people who are caught in that cycle of, well, it's on sale, it's a deal, I have to buy it. It's not a good deal for you if you don't have the financial or physical space for it. So I have to be cautious about picking something up. Now, I will say our freezer is probably 10% full.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, I don't have it like full. I didn't buy half a cow or anything like that. But I do like having the space for it.
The other thing that you got to be disciplined about is shopping for yourself first before you go to the grocery store.
From yourself.
Yes. Like, look at what you have in your overflow freezer before you go grocery shopping. Cause I know that's something that, like, we've both done is like, oh, we're going to make this. And you just go out, you know, it's on your meal plan list. So you get the ingredients for it when you go shopping, and you forget that you have 6 pounds of butter in the freezer when you, you know, could have just got that from yourself. So it doesn't actually save you money.
Yeah. If the stockpile is just continuing to grow and you're never actually eating what's in there, it's not saving you any money. So yeah, some things that you could do to combat that would be like 1 week a month, you have like a freezer clean out. I know Alex on Instagram, I can't remember her handle, but her phrase is we use what we have. She did a whole week of content on a freezer clean out where she would just go down in her freezer and find something random in there and pull it out and figure out something to make with it just to actually use it. And so that can help, you know, if you have a random week where an unexpected expense came up, and so you're trying to offset some expense that you weren't planning for, you can make your grocery spending lower by more heavily relying on your freezer than you normally do in that week. But yes, you do have, especially because ours is in the basement in a corner where you have to basically almost walk in a circle to go down and see it. I am guilty of bringing groceries home and then taking food down into the freezer and being like, oh, we already have three of that.
We already have bagels and bagels and bagels.
And more bagels. And all one kind. We only buy everything bagel. So we're not adding variety either. Here's what I'll say is, for sure, you can find a deal on them. Like, you do not need to go to Lowe's and buy a brand new chest freezer. That's the kind of thing I see all the time on Facebook Marketplace. You could even post on Facebook or Instagram and say, does anybody have a chest freezer in their basement or garage that they're just not using anymore that I can, you know, take off your hands? And either you're going to end up getting it for free, or if somebody is like, oh yeah, we have it and I've just never even thought of selling it or getting rid of it, how about $50? I don't think if, you know, if you're like, yeah, let's get one, I don't think it's the kind of thing that you have to go buy you new, or that even is beneficial or helpful to buy it new versus just getting it used.
Yeah. The one that we have was my grandparents, and it's probably 20 years old.
Oh, at least. It has a brown handle on it. It's more like...
That was bygone era of appliances.
Yeah. The like goldish yellow.
Yeah.
The fridge itself is like that off-white, and then the handle is that brownish fake wood. So I would say it's more like in the 90s.
Right. So you definitely don't need to get a brand new one because...
In fact, the way appliances go, the older it is, the better, the longer it might last.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So chest freezers. Maybe worth it as long as you can be disciplined.
Yeah, worth it if you have a little bit of thought into how you're going to use it wisely.
Yep. This has been Not Worth Your Money on the Debt-Free Mom podcast, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Debt-Free Mom podcast. If you want to join me as a guest on the show, go to dfmpodcast.com. The Debt-Free Mom podcast is hosted by me, Carly Hill, and is produced, edited, and mixed by Kyle Hill. Music for this episode was written by Kyle Hill. Hit subscribe wherever you're listening to join in with every new episode as we grow our confidence and contentment in our personal finances.